This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Thanks very much, Nina. I'll begin with a couple of apologies. This is the title I proposed when I was invited here, but I haven't. Although I did quite a lot of work on the first European semester, my work on the second one is far from complete, and then we're now in the middle of the third. So I've cobbled together some stuff from other presentations, including mostly a debate which I had last week with a member of the Commission, DG Economics and Finance. So basically what I have is a policy critique. That's the first apology. The second apology is there is absolutely no conceptual originality in what I'm about to say. I do have both a Marxist and a post-Keynesian formation, but my own thinking is of the most promiscuous eclecticism imaginable. So think of this as light relief in a quite a heavy conceptual day. Okay. So I start with the Russian questions after any fantastic thing goes wrong. For example, you have a gender-biased conference, you have to ask these two questions. Now, I'm going to concentrate on the first, because I think the answer to the second, those who are responsible should assume their responsibilities. So we'll start with the boom in Europe. The Commission responsibility in a financial crisis. This is the Leikkanen report, which is a recent report on banking union, which might be one component of a way out of the current mess. The crisis also highlighted the danger of putting market integration first and building the policy integration later. That sounds like they're talking about an individual mistake. Actually, it more or less summarizes the history of the European Union since about 1983. Okay, what it was about in the boom was essentially deregulation and deregulating of finance, the most uncritical imitation of American financial structures and systems. Uncritical because although the scale of the markets was emulated, the actual structures of social control that exist to some extent in the United States were certainly not. And that's the scandalous statement in Stockholm Council. The European Union is to become the cheapest and easiest place to do business in the world. It was only subsequently that it was learned that cheap and easy business is not always good business. A key aspect of this was financial integration, which took a completely deregulatory form. Early in the process of financial integration, the whole process was clogged by the very heavy procedures and procedural delays in a European committee structure. And Alexander Lamfalussy was brought in to accelerate and rationalise the process of financial integration, which I think more or less did. He wrote of the dangers. He wrote this in the draft Lamfalussy report, 2002. Greater efficiency does not necessarily go hand in hand with enhanced stability. Increased integration of securities markets entails more interconnection, the fashionable word, isn't it? Cross-border basis, exposure to common shocks, etc., etc. Yeah. And this statement was in the first Lamfalussy report. It was not in the final Lamfalussy report because of this. It was politely but firmly suggested that we drop the subject. Yeah. Okay, so I didn't invent this term, the hooligans. I stole it from Jan Kramers, who's a Dutch member of European Parliament. He was talking about another one of their beautiful inventions, which is a thing called the Bolkestein Directive. Some of you, anybody with interest in European labour relations from Norbert Bolkestein directive. A directive which was combined union busting and juridical chaos. But they also were going for subprime, and actually the Commission website doesn't make it clear that they were going hell for leather. They were gung-ho for subprime and were about to attempt to abolish mortgage law and housing regulation and social housing structures in all the member states, which had evolved over hundreds of years. Many, that's to say themselves, hooligans would be the better way to read. Many hooligans expressed the view that the further integration of the EU mortgage market could be considerably enhanced by the emergence of a pan-European funding market. There was absolutely no need for a pan-European funding market because wholesale markets had already integrated large-scale capital movements. So this was, to begin, at least a fatuous proposal. Now, what they do, what DG internal market do all the time, and it's terrifying from the democratic point of view, is they get this tame bunch of contract economists to endorse the proposals. And it has, the way I've put it in another context, if you have a market in the research, that the danger is that the customer will get exactly what he wants. And that's what London Economics, who are responsible this time, came up with. So this is from the London Economics Report. This is page 168 of that report, which I'm going to track them down. Removing restrictions on maximum mortgage interest rates would allow a subprime mortgage market to develop, thus expanding total mortgage lending. I was at the European Economic Council in the spring of 2007. They were still coming out with this stuff. DG internal markets still coming out with this stuff. And when I called them, it was very embarrassing because I called them hooligans. And it turned out to be represented by this very pleasant Irish lady. I've never been called a hooligan before. But that indeed is what she was. In December of that year, the white paper on mortgages finally found it. This is the biggest lie I've come across in nearly 50 years in academia. Recent events in global mortgage markets have confirmed the pertinence of the approach. Actually, recent events in global mortgage markets had revealed the absurdity of the approach. And at that point, from that point on, you need 100 clicks to find mortgages on the Commission website. Okay, but that's not the only achievement of the hooligans. We also had leveraging. This is what they said they'd achieved. I've got this leveraging Europe behind. European banks are well capitalised. This is the DG internal market. The origin, the European banks are well capitalised. That is not a lie, it's just an error. Where financial institutions have sizable direct exposures to the US subprime market and indirect exposure through structured products, the affected entities have well diversified portfolios and large capital buffers. Yeah. So this is Munchau quoting the Financial Stability Report. Much more shocking was that the lion's share of these assets, that's to say the bad assets, belong to European, not North American banks, the total 4 trillion. The global banking system accounts for 3 trillion, of that a little over half is sitting in European banks, you get the picture. So that's not the only achievements of the hooligans in the first decade of the present century. I could mention the attack on consumer protection and retail finance, which is boring and holds up integration. So let's have the British system of consumer protection rather than the Danish one. No, in other words, let's not have any consumer protection. And effective systems of consumer protection and retail finance were described as gold plating. Now, if you, in the European Union, you can have higher labour standards than your neighbours. You can have higher consumer protection standards than your neighbours. You can have higher environmental standards than your neighbours. And that does slow down integration, but the consequence is that when integration does take place, it takes place on a high level. And throughout the Financial Services Action Plan, the Commission were trying to undermine that principle in retail finance. Fortunately, the events have probably persuaded them that that's not the way to go. So that's who is responsible, the boom. So let's look at who's responsible, the bust. So this is a summary from Elliott and Brand. It's not particularly original, but they say essentially what's happened in the bust, you could sum up as in three areas. First, banking's not been cleaned up. And this is now being repeated. Helvig's recent work, every IMF report is saying, and there's quite a lot of bad stuff hanging around in French and German banks. It's not all Greek and Portuguese banks that are that. And this, the failure to have a thorough cleaning of banks' balance sheets paralyzes or at least impairs the functioning of the credit system and the payment system. That's the first mistake. Failure to isolate the Greek crisis. Actually, Greece is a very small economy and a comprehensive rescue of Greece. I don't mean what I call the Greek situation seems to me to take us back to the happy situation in Charles Dickens' early novels, where you didn't actually have bankruptcy. All you had was the debtor's prison. And that's what we seem to have but failure to isolate the Greek crisis, and that if there's no Greek crisis, there's no Italian crisis and no Spanish crisis. So what muddling through does for you. And the fiscal adjustment is supervised. So austerity. Okay, now what have been the actual responses? If those are the failures to respond, the sins of omission, the sins of commission, I summarise as the surveillance union. We have Kafkaesque structure of surveillance, which is Kafkaesque both in being quite sinister and also being richly comic. So the six-pack, stronger surveillance, reinforced penalties, etc., automaticity of penalties, etc. And now this interesting notion that as well as excessive deficits, we're going to have excessive imbalances. You hear the stable doors being slammed over some past mistakes, because obviously the problem was not one of public debt but of other macroeconomic imbalances. So now we'll shut that stable door. Nobody is proposing to get our horse back, so we'll end up with you know, a very decorated stable and no horse. The excessive imbalances are summed up in the scoreboard. That's what I mean by richly comic. You have there are 10 macroeconomic variables that have to be within the right thresholds, or otherwise there could be litigation. I mean, it's absurd. Anybody who knows anything about macroeconomics would find it. Nearly all of these indicators, 10 of them, refer to competitiveness in one form or another, apart from the very last one, which if you have lots and lots of unemployment, it might be regarded as an imbalance. I'll show you some of the figures later. They give themselves 3 years to get 10% is roughly the average level of unemployment in the European Eurozone today, in the European Monetary Union today. Okay. We have, as well as that, we have the two-pack, the submission of national budgets to the Commission, and the right of the latter to propose charges. Independent bodies, that's to say, everybody's got to have an office for budget responsibility. Haven't they done well looking at the forecasts that they've come out with since the spring, since the early summer of 2010? Everybody should have an OBR. Yes, it enables a precise fine-tuning of your fiscal strategy. And we have also for those in the naughty chair, we have a rather more unpleasant regime. Then we have the fiscal compact, and the main thing of the fiscal compact is that on top of the 3% limit on actual deficits, we have a 0.5% limit on structural deficits. A structural deficit requires you to say what the output gap is. And they're going to litigate on a variable that depends on an estimate of the output gap, What would you say is the output gap in the Eurozone today? I'd say somewhere between 5% and 25%, but who knows? So the semester, which I promised you, it's a circle of policy supervision, policy examination, reformulation, which I have absolutely no objection to. It's the content of the semester. I looked at the first one, but I did that when Engelbert invited me to Kingston. I'm not going to do it again. The point about the first semester was that it was just nonsense. It predicted, the predictions for rapid economic recovery were already falsified. The first semester began in the spring of 2011. By the autumn of 2011, the whole set of forecasts had to be junked, because they no longer corresponded to macroeconomic situation. And they also implied various things like export surges, investment booms, and other nice things which didn't happen. So I have looked briefly at the last complete semester, which is the stability programs that were produced in 2012. They're not nearly as over-optimistic as the previous year's ones are, but they're still way too optimistic, because you notice that the average performance in the Eurozone is going to violate the scorecard threshold for the Eurozone as a whole. Maybe they'll litigate against themselves in aggregate, and they can all appear in the dock. So the growth figures I calculate are also nonsense. They're not quite as absurdly optimistic as they were before, but they're still predicting growth this year, which will not take place, according to the Commission. And as for what they say about 2014, the errors are so systematic that you can probably discount. Life in the debtor's prison. This is the worst case, I think, of the surveillance state. What it does is it actually de-responsibilizes the Greek state. You read the Greek report, the most recent one, on national reform program. The Greeks are saying, oh, sorry, we can't do anything about that. We can't do anything about that. A troika have tied our hands here. They've clamped down on the stairs. There's nothing that we can do. So, in fact, you're actually robbing the government of capacity to address the problems of the people. It's an absurd. So, for example, this is what they're supposed to do. Reduce. Can you see Angela Merkel saying, you must cut down on your pharmaceutical expenditure? But not by 1 billion, by 1.076. The reduction in the number of deputy mayors and associated staff. Actually, the structure of local government in Greece seems to me to be an issue for the Greeks. I've got a new word for this. I'm going to call it subsidiarity. And even if the Greek state is insolvent, it still seems to me to be the case that the structure of local government remains a matter for the Greeks. I don't see what good it can possibly do the creditors to this. Okay. This is the thing which would take us into what is to be done. This is the rule which says that central bank can't finance governments on any. It's a very comprehensive, well-written rule. So I think I'll finish by just talking about painting yourself into a corner. The British painted themselves into a similar corner with the Bank Charter Act, which put a limit on the banknotes that the Bank of England could issue without gold backing. And it became a problem every time there was a financial crisis. The Bank of England was handicapped in its actions of lender of last resort because it couldn't bring banknotes. But they found a solution. The solution was that the Chancellor of the Exchequer wrote a letter to the Governor of the Bank of England. And he said, should you happen to break the law in these turbulent times, I will introduce an Act of Parliament which exonerates you. And the later crisis of the 19th century, They didn't have to have an Act of Parliament. They didn't even have to print or issue the banknotes. The mere fact that the letter had been written stabilised the markets and restored calm. And what we have, I think the solution is going to be that José Barroso will write to Mario Draghi and say, Mario, you might have to step over a few thresholds in the coming months, but if you do, we'll have a new treaty of 27 countries. And I'll propose it. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.